I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where I'm forced every week to come up with the location that we're coming from and camp this week here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today for the first time, we're so thrilled to have Esther Zuckerman. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I don't know why I waved. I love it. It's a podcast, but I'm waving.
Our patrons will be able to see you. So
you're waving at the patrons. Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on, Esther, to talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm, which, so there was a one-hour HBO special that aired in 1999. I'm going to be perfectly upfront. I can't go that deep on Curb. So I'm thrilled that you guys are here to talk more in depth about this series than I can. But I didn't know this existed. Like, I didn't know that there was like a 1 hour thing, which I'm assuming was like a test balloon to see whether or not was it.
Oh, really?
No, it was just like a 1 hour thing. Okay.
This is Larry. I mean, Esther, can you speak to this? Like, I'm going to, you know, make stuff up. Can you speak to this? More?
No, I mean,
did you know this existed? This I know was, you're a Curb fan, but did you know that this existed?
I'm a Curb fan, but I didn't have a great knowledge of this special. I think I had watched it like maybe once, but I didn't, when I rewatched it for the purpose of the podcast, like I didn't really remember a lot of it. I think they did a one-off special and then this became the idea for the series rather than let's do a test to make it to see if a series is going to work, you know,
because it's not really a pilot,
I guess,
is what's interesting about it. Like it sort of is rounded off, like it's its own thing, I guess. After, you can see where the show comes from
after but, you know. 22 years of Curb, one form or another. This doesn't seem that special. But I watched this in college. Okay. I remember watching it in like must have been 01 or 02 because they would replay it all the time. It's called Larry David : Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And we thought it was pretty revolutionary at the time.
Really?
And I still do think it's pretty revolutionary in its own way. I mean, it is a meta commentary on how a behind the cameras person, you know, transitions to in front of the camera. It is a kind of humor that we really hadn't seen before outside of Seinfeld, but it's, you know, this kind of R-rated Seinfeld thing. Shackles are off for Larry. I think that there's a reason that this turned into a 22-year phenomenon. And I think it's all kind of there in the beginning. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's great, but I think it's great. I think it's amazing. I you know what I mean? I think it's kind of like for the moment, for the time, it kind of floored me. That's what you think.
One of the things that struck me about it was that, you know, the structure of Curb episodes is something that I find so special, because basically every Curb episode has multiple storylines that sort of orbit each other, and then Larry's behavior ends up like biting him in the ass every single time, and they sort of converge in a sort of magical way. You know, and because the structure of the show is so loose and there's so much improv, it does feel sort of special, but it always ends up, and this one sort of, and the special sort of does the same thing. You know, it starts out with this idea that he's gonna do the stand-up set. He's going back into stand-up, but then there's a side plot about him doing a recommendation for an assistant who was on Seinfeld, and then that loops around to the very end. And I think that circular structure of Curb episodes is so special. And the fact that it was able to come around to like happen in that very first attempt and just kept repeating itself, like, sort of amazed me rewatching it.
This is the underrated thing about Larry David. I think, all right, now, I think Larry David is a marvel. I think he is a magician. I think he is a national treasure. I think he's like one of our great humorists and personalities and minds. And if it wasn't for that ridiculous crypto ad, he would literally have a spotless record. But
so upset by that.
Very upsetting. It's very upsetting. And I was upset when Matt Damon did it too. I mean, you know, they must be throwing just insane amounts of money. And like, I think Larry's like, I don't know. But I think the thing with Larry that you're speaking to, Esther, is this pilot, this show, this
special whatever,
speaks to the core of Larry David, which is he comes off like somebody who can't be bothered with your bullshit. But what he really can't be bothered with is rote, typical, normal, boring bullshit. He's not going to bother doing it unless it's really, really great. And like you're saying, like what you're talking about with Curb, I can tell you, having been in comedy rooms, that's the goal of every fucking television show, to do exactly what every comedy show. That, you know, and if you take improv, that's the improv structure. It's this, but my point is, he nails it almost every time, and almost every other show never nails it. And they start mailing it in. They start going into this like, well, you know, as long as it's funny and like we didn't pay this off, but like, you know, people are going to like this. Larry won't settle. And I fucking love that about
To that this. Point, and I think that it's worth noting too, he's the first guy that I can think of where he's like, I'll do the show when I have an idea. The show will be back when I feel like bringing the show back. And that's rare too, right? I mean, there have been...
Not anymore, but yeah.
Not anymore, but he was the first guy. He kind of broke new ground in the sense that he's like, I'll be gone for 3 or 4 years and I'll come back when I feel like I have something that's worth doing. I think that's interesting. I think there's... I mean, obviously he's got the freedom of being on HBO, but still it makes it feel special when it comes back.
Yeah, I mean this is now essentially the model for a lot of our better comedies in particular. This is what Donald Glover does. This is what Bill Hader does. Yeah. This is the model.
Louis C.K. did.
For a minute, and people didn't even recognize that Larry was paving the way in that respect. Like, if you reach this level, like there was this idea, and Louis C.K. is
obviously a problematic figure at this point, but
the dirt worst, but a but kind of an important person in the trajectory of auteur driven comedy on TV. In that, I remember when Louis, you know, started and was a hit and a bit of a phenomenon and all that stuff, everybody was asking for the Louis deal. Right. I want, give me half the budget, but total freedom. Give me, you know, let me do it on my time. Let me hire my people, but like, and don't bother me. And Donald Glover got it. And Bill Hader kind of got it. Yeah. And, you know, there are other people who've kind of gotten it. But what they're really asking for is a Larry David deal. No one really understood that. It almost seemed like he was a unicorn. He's been doing it for 20 years. But yeah,
I mean, it definitely feels like FX looked at this and said, this is definitely the model of what we want to be doing, right? Which is relatively lo-fi, relatively low budget, you know, auteur driven comedy. It's interesting. I mean, it's also, yeah, please ask her. Yeah.
Oh, but I was going to say, what's so special about Curb and versus everything else that we're talking about is how fucking funny it is every single time. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's like the thing that, you know, Louis pioneered that obviously Donald Glover does with Atlanta and Bill Hader will do with all the people that you mentioned is, you know, it'll be very funny and they'll have, you know, but then they'll take wild sort of creative diversions that'll get very serious and you'll have episodes that are long monologues and you'll have episodes that don't have anything to do. The thing about that's magic about Curb is it's still the same. Like, and it's still the same essentially as this special, basically. And that feels so unique. Like, it is still a sitcom, you know?
And I would also say, too,
that's such a good point.
To that point, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, is that it still feels like it's touching on Larry's actual life, right? Like, it still feels... Yeah. Despite the fact that, and I agree with you guys, that I didn't necessarily love the 1 hour special, it was one of the first mockumentary shows, right? Where it's kind of, and I didn't really like the talking head shit that they did in the special, and thankfully they got rid of all that in the series. But the fact that the fly on the wall kind of component of just sort of existing in a version of Larry's kind of existence, I think also makes this feel lighter. I mean, the thing about Atlanta and the thing about Louis' show is that both of those are, as you said, sort of dramedies. You know what I mean? They're existing in this very different kind of universe. Whereas this feels like, I mean, in particular, if you look at the Seinfeld season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, where, you know, which is brilliant on so many levels.
The best.
You know what I mean? In terms of just being able to sort of, you know, recontextualize a finale to Seinfeld that nobody seemed to really like. And you know what I mean? It's so except Kenny.
I bet you liked it as me too.
I didn't hate it, but the general audiences seemed less than thrilled with the way the show ended.
But that's definitely true. I totally agree with you. The general dummies didn't like it. But you know, the morons didn't like Sopranos either. So what are you gonna do?
I mean, it's interesting. The talking head things is interesting. It was interesting that I think HBO was doing like a lot of that around the time. Like the Sex and the City pilot also has the talking heads does. Element, brutal. Which is so bad.
Yeah.
The first season, it's terrible and they get rid of it. But also the talking heads thing feels like what's so funny watching the special now is that like we now have this innate knowledge of who Larry David is. And the talking heads have to introduce this guy to the world because obviously people didn't know they knew Seinfeld, but they didn't know Larry David. So you sort of had to have Jason Alexander sitting there being like, he's George.
He's
you
me.
Know, this is who he is. You have he's me. Like they had to explain that, which is again this sort of like weird time travel phenomenon where you're like, now the idea of Larry David is so ingrained, almost even I'd say to a certain extent, Seinfeld. More so than some of the Seinfeld characters. Yeah.
He has managed to somehow eclipse Seinfeld. I think that I think Seinfeld is benighted in some sense, know, it's untouchable, not Jerry so much, Seinfeld the show, but and Jerry too, but I think Jerry, you know, the fact that he hasn't been able to follow it up has not, and he has tried, has not looked great.
Also, wouldn't you argue that Jerry's kind of hasn't aged well? like as a person, like I have a lot of love for Jerry Seinfeld too.
Like a lot of love for Jerry
Seinfeld. As you should.
But I would say he hasn't aged gracefully. And I would say the Shoshana Lowenstein stuff still looms pretty large, like in kind of a what exactly were we ignoring type way, or what exactly were we letting him get away with type way. But
I think in addition to the Shoshana Lowenstein stuff, which has aged, which is very upsetting in many ways, there's something interesting about the comparison between Jerry and Larry in terms of wealth. Somehow, Jerry's wealth and the way Jerry projects his wealth and has projected his wealth in follow-up stand-up sets, in comedians in cars getting coffee, feels so unrelatable that it makes it sort of impossible to get on board with him. I think, and somehow, even though Larry has a ton of wealth on Curb Your Enthusiasm, even all these seasons later, somehow he has managed to make it so that we're aware of his wealth, we're aware of his privilege, and yet we can still find something inherent in it. And I think maybe it sort of almost goes back to what, you know, I can't remember who says it in the in one of the talking head points. It might have been Jerry, that like this man, no matter what has happened to him in his life, is the same. And maybe that's what works, is that like this man is the same. He's got the same foibles. He's got the same things that bother him. But Jerry's wealth feels icky in a way. And somehow Larry's wealth feels like we can still watch it and laugh about it.
Jerry's wealth is fucking icky. It's a really good point. It's a really, really good point, because the thing with it's so interesting you bring that up, because as Seinfeld went from the show that was going to get canceled to, you know, cover of Rolling Stone to the biggest show on TV to, $1 million an episode thing, plus I think more for those guys, and then he gets offered the $5 million an episode and turns it down. It was all about money by the end of it. And then we learned about his estate in, you know, the Hamptons and all, and Jessica Seinfeld, you know, and all these things that like project wealth. And then comedian in cars getting coffee is a disaster in that respect, because comedians in cars getting coffee is not bad when they're getting coffee.
Yeah.
No, but when it's him talking about his car,
it's like, this guy is not for me. You know, it's like you go, you and Jay Leno can go hang out with your fucking cars, but you're not for me. And I think that's a really good point about Larry. As you're talking, I'm thinking about, okay, so what is Larry's issue, problem, general want every episode? Because he has none. Outside of, he really just wants to like live his life unbothered. Yes. You know?
He's supposed to be
and
alone.
Also,
I think we can all relate to
that. The thing about most Curb episodes is like, a lot of times, Larry is right. And that's the sort of, I think that is the crucial sort of crux of a lot of Curb's appeal, is that even Larry has his own moral code that once you watch enough of it starts to make sense. And a lot of times, then you start to be like, yeah, you know, he's being the reasonable person here. He's not acting in a reasonable way, but his essential desire is reasonable, if that makes sense. I mean, like, I'm thinking of the most recent season, but the one before with Mocha Joe, and it's like, yeah, everyone wants tables that don't wobble. Everyone wants coffee that's hot. Like all of these like things that seem, you know, that he is making a big deal about, and you would never make a big deal of it in the way that Larry makes a big deal. And yet he's also sort of right.
Part of it is also stems a little bit from like, you know, Seinfeld, the series was about the mundane, right? It was about the things that we do on a daily basis, which is why everybody loves that show, I think, to some degree or another. And Curb is an extension of that, right? It's all about Larry's kind of mundane choices and what have you. The problem is that Seinfeld as a human has lost touch with that stuff, I would argue.
Well,
like the grounded, believable world problems.
But Seinfeld, people, rightfully so, because there's nothing really like it, conflate these two shows. You know, almost as if it's the idea of like Curb is just Seinfeld, you know, on location. And Seinfeld is just Curb on set. It's not. It is about the mundane to some extent, but it's also about the fantastical. There are so many things in Seinfeld that are so out of, you know, the realm of actual real human interaction. That's so much of the charm of that show. I mean, literally any episode, it's just so fun. It's Curb is are things that could happen that are annoying. Seinfeld are things that maybe would happen one time to one person in the history of the world, right? Like maybe one guy had a Kenny Rogers roaster sign outside of his apartment window. And that guy was Kramer, and it was always Kramer. And this shit is very, like, I think Seinfeld is like gonzo and brilliant and so funny and so wild and so silly and such a joy. But Curb is really like, and Esther, I want to speak to your point about Larry being right. Larry is the best character in TV to write for, because Larry is always right, because Larry is always right. Now, what I'm getting at is, like, he can take either side of an argument, and the way he presents it, you know, and he doesn't do it in an annoying way or whatever, but the way he presents it, you're like, yeah, that is annoying. But you never know. Like, a guy cuts him. Guy cuts in front of him in line, right, at the buffet, and he takes umbrage. But he could also be the guy cutting in front of the guy at the buffet. You'd be like, well, yeah, this guy was taking forever. And he has this amazing both sides quality that I think people don't appreciate that either, which is, if you really look at it, like, it all is about perspective. So,
I mean, and clearly he does awful things.
Sometimes.
Like, you know, sometimes for his own benefit. But there is, I mean, I think I said this before, so I don't mean to repeat myself, but there's an essential sort of like reasonableness to Larry, even when he's being unreasonable.
And there's
Would you also
just
say
that, I don't, yeah.
He's also kind of cursed and blessed. Do you know what I mean? Like, the show is playing both sides of that, which is that Larry frequently gets his way and doesn't get his way, and that's okay, that it goes both ways. Like, I feel like the show, by and large, the twists, if you want to call it twists, at the end of each episode tends to be Larry gets screwed somehow by Larry. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that he's his own worst enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's also like the arc of the seasons usually. Like when there are sort of like seasonal arcs, like the Tracy Ullman stuff in this past season. Like he ends up fucking it up eventually, or you know, the producers, you know, the producers season where he ends up.
That's one of my favorite things. I mean,
trying to do the producers, but then end up working.
But the producers,
you know, like,
the producers are doing the producers with Larry. It's so good. Like Mel Brooks and Mel,
you know,
was it Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft toasting to the end of the show because Larry is starring in it? It's so good. It's like that. Yeah, I love that season. I love Larry being silly and big and like, I love him feeling himself, like kind of recognizing that he is kind of like this interesting talent. I mean, there's a season where he had the pass, Charles gave him the pass, and all the whole season he was like, who am I gonna sleep with. But I think the bedrock of this whole thing, and this is true in Larry's real life and this is true in the show, and I think they go hand in hand because he is playing a version of himself, is Larry's fundamental decency. Like, fundamentally, like, there are things he says and does in the show that if another character who didn't have 25 or 30 years of goodwill did them, like, this whole last season. There's a lot of things in this season that I think with other people's hands and with other main characters, you might be like, this is not great. But with him, I think we have a sense of the where his heart lies,
sure.
where the real Larry David's yes. heart lies, and the gentle mocking that I think has been. Yeah, go ahead, Esther.
I'm sorry, but the this most recent season, the finale, the shoes, like the shoes get wet, he takes off his shoes, he's at the Holocaust Museum, he puts on a pair of Holocaust shoes. Like, it is, I was sitting watching it with my boyfriend, and we turned to each other,
Holocaust shoes.
And are like, as he, there's a moment when he looks at the pile of shoes and he looks back, and we're like, holy shit, is he gonna do this? Is he gonna actually do this? And he does it, and you're sort of like, and then he finds the shoes very comfortable. Yeah. And it's like, only he can somehow, I'm not sure anyone else can really make that joke work. It's astounding.
I fully agree with you. I was also pretty shocked as it was playing out in a way that I was like, I can't believe that they're doing this and that it's working and that somehow they're getting away with it is really pretty incredible. And I also, I think it's worth noting, not to get political, but I do think it's worth noting that his his Bernie Sanders is also one of those things where I think it's softened Bernie. Do you know what I mean? To some degree, I think that any issues that people might have had with him, to some degree, Larry David becoming the stand-in for him made it all feel a little bit funnier, made it all feel a little bit more, as you said, relatable. On top of it being the perfect person to play Bernie Sanders, he's a fascinating figure in pop culture in that way, which is that, and I think Kenny said this earlier, Larry David's always Larry David. Like, I don't ever think that it's really changing. Like, even if he is Bernie Sanders, he's basically just Larry David, just sounding a little bit more curmudgeonly, I guess. But I think it's pretty fascinating. I also think it's worth noting, too, just for what it's worth to our listeners, in terms of a brief synopsis, in this HBO special upon which the series is based, Larry approaches HBO about having his own hour-long HBO special. After a long hiatus, Larry begins performing stand-up again in order to prepare for the special. However, hours from the show's scheduled filming, Larry becomes nervous, lies to the HBO executives about the illness of a non-existent stepfather in order to get the special canceled. After Larry is seen with a young woman, Cheryl accuses him of cheating. She has him swear on his children's lives, discovering it to be Jeff who is cheating. This episode was written by Larry David, directed by Robert. Is it Wide?
Whitey?
No.
It's not. It is Whitey, right?
Okay, I believe
you. Or is it Whitey? It's Whitey. Yeah, it's like Whitey. Yeah.
It aired on October 1st, 1999. It's got 80% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and audiences. The LA Times said exceptional, except for occasional belabored moments, the rest of the mockumentary ranges from genial to hilarious, with the self-spoofing David as himself amid a company of actors convincingly playing his manager, wife, friends, and associates. I think what's interesting about, first of all, like, this special looks terrible.
It looks horrible. Like,
visually
unwatchable.
I mean, also, even like the font, is it like, it's like borderline Comic Sans.
It is like, Comic Sans, I think. It's like, this is HBO pre-money. Yes. And I mean, it had obviously Time Warner, but it just didn't put money into its shit. And it, like, if you look at stuff from before The Sopranos and Sex and the City, essentially, and this I think would count because it was before the big boom of those shows, they looked just revolting. And this looks revolting. But I also, So I remember when, this is a bit of a tangent, I remember when Comedy Central started as a network, and I was very young. I was like in middle school or whatever, or even elementary school. I was very savvy. And I remember thinking, this will never work, because like, nothing is less funny than someone coming at you and being like, we're the funny guys.
Right.
So the idea of Comedy Central, yet what happened pretty quickly, and it didn't work for a while, by the way. Like, it had horrible stand-up specials from B-rate talent. It was just, it was not a great place for a while. Mm-hmm. But what happened very quickly is people who were not really, you know, being able to do their thing on network TV mm-hmm. found a home there and were allowed to experiment and do really cool things. And now, you know, there are, like, from The Daily Show to South Park to, you know, Broad City, there are just, like, countless examples of Comedy Central shows that have been really important. Mm-hmm. I think HBO original programming is somewhat similar in that they had original programming from, you know, the 80s, but it was mostly just, you know, shitty talent doing shitty things on shitty budgets with shitty actors that no one really, you know, acknowledged. It was like bad TV, like basic cable stuff. And then some people came along and I, you know, it's not really the David
Real sex,
like, yeah, or real sex. Yeah, it's not really the David Chases I give credit to, it's more like the Brad Grays I give credit to, who like recognize that, like, we actually have an opportunity here to tell cinematic stories, well, even on a low budget.
I mean, I think Sex and the City does predate Sopranos, no, in terms
but
of,
but again, like, that's yeah. not, I wouldn't necessarily even give credit to a Michael Patrick King for that. I'd give credit to, like, a, you know, Darren Star. That.
Yeah.
Michael Patrick King plays HBO publicist in I kept like looking at this, like, is that Michael Patrick King? Weird.
Regarding this particular show, thing, this doesn't exist anywhere else. This would never make it on a network. This would never be on a network. This would never be in theaters. This would never work on basic cable. Like, Larry found the medium for his message before anyone realized that there was a medium for his message. And I think that's pretty brilliant too. I think as much as Seinfeld and Sex and the City, because I think people hold those up as, like, you know, the twin pillars of HBO, Curb has to be the third. Because Curb is the other one that broke the medium and showed that this is another way. Like, Sex and City did. Sex and City basically said you could take your comedies on location and you could start talking about things that people don't talk about on network TV and center characters that don't get centered on TV. Curb said, forget your form. Like, whatever form you've been using, like, you don't need it anymore over here. Sure. And I think Curb is, you know, incredible. The fact that it still exists, I think, means that people have not been able to put it in historical context the way they have with those other two shows. But it's right there. It is equally as important, if not more important.
Mm-hmm. And yet, that's so interesting. It is so interesting because it's to what you were saying earlier, Kenny, that, like, the form is also sort of, like, inherently, like, the most basic form in a way. You know, you can break the form, but you're also, you know, A plot, B plot, it all comes back around, you know, like, the form is so elemental in a way. I don't know.
I think that's a good point too. I think, you know, I think Larry very clearly felt like, well, the fundamentals of TV writing have never changed. You know, like, that, like, the fact that people are trying to get away from that is the problem. But look at what else we can do. We can be on location. We can shoot with handheld cameras. We can, have talking heads. We can cast people as themselves. We can, very interestingly in this pilot, we can talk about, you know, taboo subjects like infidelity in a way that's not judgmental, which is like one of its most shocking, like, components of this. You know, and they do that now with Jeff. And I was talking to my friend and he said, you know, I think Jeff has gone too far with the cheating and they used to never do that. I'm like, I just watched the pilot. He was doing it. Jeff has always been a dog.
I think that was the thing. So I did a full rewatch over the pandemic. It was truly like the only thing I could watch at a certain point. And I think that is one of the things that, you know, this gets at, but, like, Jeff is sort of from the beginning disgusting. Like, you know, I think you sort of, there's this weird moment where he's like, where I think in that, I think maybe in sort of like the absence between seasons like 9 and 10, people sort of rewrote Jeff maybe as like, sort of like, oh, he's sort of like cuddly sidekick guys, but he's always been cheating. Like, there's that episode with the massage where Larry, you know, he sends Larry to his masseuse, who's like,
it's the first episode I ever watched of this show.
Like nine pumps, right?
Yeah.
And Jeff has always been gross. I think, like, it's interesting that it leans into the sort of, like, Cheryl hates Jeff sort of thing in the special, which I feel like is a little bit muted in the series, maybe because Cheryl tends to align herself with Susie, who doesn't, who, like, obviously emerges and becomes, like, the great hero of Curb Your Enthusiasm, in my opinion. But yeah, Jeff has always been gross, like just absolutely gross.
Jeff is the world's worst, and he is also the best illustration of a male friend on TV. Like, this is the, now I'm not saying I have these friends, and truthfully, thank God I don't, but you'll find yourselves in situations as a boy where you meet people like, say, like friends of your brother-in-law or friends of your cousin or people who are like two steps removed from you, who all of a sudden start talking about going to sex workers or how much they love like happy endings or things that you're just like things that you kind of can't even believe like are happening in polite conversation. And you're just like, this is awful, and I don't know how you hang out with these people. But they do. People you love, people you care about, people you think like are like good, decent people do hang out with these people who are like, kind of disgusting negative influences. And also don't judge them for it. Don't like drop them. And it's just kind of like, whatever, teach their own. I've known this guy forever. That's Jeff. And I think it's like, I think the non-judgmental nature of Larry's relationship with him may not be something that we would put on TV today, but its existence, I think, is really kind of revolutionary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I also think there is this interesting dynamic between like the roles that Jeff and Larry play on the series, in that Jeff is disgusting. He's the worst. He's cheating on his wife all the time. He's horrible. And yet Larry is always the person who's sort of more unacceptable in like public company. Larry is the one who's being yelled at. Larry is the one who people are shaking their fists at, Larry David, because Larry's just, it sort of goes back to the idea of like Larry being the weirdly reasonable one, because Larry's just the person who's afraid to tell people what they don't want to hear. And Jeff is horrible, but his horribleness is the sort of horribleness to where you're talking about, Kenny, that like people just accept all the time and it sort of like rolls off people's shoulders. Whereas Larry's right a lot of the time, but he'll say it and it's, you know, and it's somehow more offensive than Jeff being a cheating jerk.
A pig, yeah.
Can I also say, you know, as you guys were talking, really something kind of occurred to me as well, which is that like, you know, so many articles have been written about the HBO antihero, right? And the ground that was broken by your Tony Sopranos and your Carrie Bradshaws to some degree as well. I think Larry is one of the great anti-heroes as well, to some degree or another. I think that that Larry has so much of this kind of built in his DNA as well, in terms of being a person that will do things that you feel like no one should do. And yet somehow he's doing them and getting away with it. I think that there's something interesting.
He's a classic anti-hero. You're totally right.
Yeah. Yes.
Totally. And I think it's fascinating, because I think that, you know, I talked about this a little bit when I did the Sex and the City miniseries on season two, and how Carrie isn't necessarily spoken of in the anti-hero conversation either, and she should be. But I think that Larry is never talked about weirdly in that conversation.
Well, again, this goes back to my one of my bête noires, which is I don't think people understand what an anti-hero is. And I think Larry is an anti-hero. I think Tony is a tragic hero. And I think these are two very different things.
Sure.
If you identify with Tony Soprano, there's a problem with you.
You're a sociopath.
The idea is, I think, to identify with him to a point and then be like, all right, I can't go any further with you. Larry's the opposite. Yeah. At the beginning, you're supposed to say, within any anti-hero, you're supposed to say, you're a problem. you're a blight on society. And then as the piece goes on, understand, oh no, you're actually really kind of, you know, you're really kind of like deep down in your core, a good person who's out for the same things we're out for, and just has a different way of going about it. And these mini little things that he does, these little, you know, small, you know, slights he internalizes, or these kind of small slights he externalizes, are meaningless in the end of the day. He's you know, he's a good friend, and he cares deeply about people, and he cares deeply about propriety. And I think he just wants things to be as equal and fair as possible. And I think that's where so much of this stuff comes from. I think so much of Larry's thing comes from is this idea of like fundamental unfairness. So often he champions the little guy.
Yep. Yep.
Oh. Yes. Yes. 100%. Like, and sometimes his championing of the little guy is completely in his own self-interest. But I think that's also, I mean, but that is interesting in the context of, like, you know, the documentary elements of this new thing. I mean, like I said this before, so I'm repeating myself, but, like, you know, the idea that this guy has always been this guy, that, like, no matter how much money he has, he's always been this person.
The story I'm thinking of is actually a Seinfeld bit, but I'm sure it came from Larry. It was when George got so upset at Mr. Pitt's store, I think, at a store that they made the security guard stand up all day. And George got the guy a chair. Yeah. And then the guy fell asleep and the store got robbed. Yeah. But it's like, that's so quintessential Larry to me, that he, like, he's an injustice in the world, and he goes and solves it, and it backfires on him. But, like, we all look at the security guard and think he should be sitting, you know?
That's very similar to, I can't remember which season, if it was this most recent season or the one before, but it's the newsstand guy. Like,
Hamm, right?
Yeah, with John Hamm. So I guess it was the season before where he is like, don't you get to take bathroom breaks? And so he and Leon start a business to help these guys, these attendants, take bathroom breaks. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, he wants everything to be a certain way. It's there, you know, that, I think that was the same season. I think that, like, I think this past season was great. I think the season before this season was impeccable. The Mocha Joe in season. And I believe that was also the season with Abby Jacobson, where she's the waitress at the club. She sweats into the soup, which is disgusting. And he's accurate in thinking that's disgusting. But then he accidentally gets her fired, and then he gives her a car. Like, it's just, there is this sort of, he does feel like he has to make things right in the world. It's in the most recent season, he gets
the girl the job.
Well, yeah, he gets the girl the job, but he also he gets the KKK guy's robe dry cleaned.
Yes, correct.
Spilled coffee. Yeah. No. The robe.
Oh, Larry, you're so great. Like,
he has to take it to the dry cleaner.
Human being. He's just an unbelievable, like, what would you do if you spilled coffee in a KKK guy's robe? Like, the thing about Larry is, again, this is why I love it. Like, he can play any side of an argument.
Yeah.
On one hand, I think people think of him as confrontational. But so many of his stories are about him trying to avoid conflict.
Yes.
Like, that story is just coming out. I understand, it doesn't matter that you hate the Jews. Like, I screwed up. That's good shit.
Yep.
And that goes back all the way to the beginning, clearly, in the special, like the Caroline Ray thing, you know, where she comes over, says hi. He mispronounces her name. She goes, Carol. And then she gets mad that he didn't say goodbye. And it's
she's very funny in it. I really like her energy. Her
fuck
you energy.
Yeah. But it's I don't know. I wouldn't say goodbye in that situation. Like, if somebody's at a different table, like, that just sort of makes sense to me. That fairness, I don't know. It's fascinating.
Well, it also speaks to, I think, arguably one of the best episodes of the Palestinian chicken episode as well.
Yes.
You know, where he's just like, they just have really good chicken, and he just refuses to not go there because there's just something very, the taboos that this show's willing, there isn't anything it's not willing to go for. You know what I mean? For a joke, and somehow find the way to navigate these landmines the Holocaust shoes being a perfect example of that, you know.
He's an exceptional stand-up comedian who is doing stand-up in this improvisational sitcom form. Because these are stand-up jokes. Like I think I think the KKK robe is brilliant because, like, how do they keep those robes so white? That's a stand-up joke, right? And then you who is dry cleaning these robes? Then that's a good joke. Yeah, and he plays that out in half hour, sitcom form. But I think, as you said this in the beginning, but I think it honestly comes down to the fact that he's just funnier than everybody else. I think there are a few people who are actually funny. Right? Like, he's actually funny. Tina Fey is actually funny.
Sure.
Like, there are these people who are just, who their shit is just so funny. And then there are, there are the people who are faking it. I would include myself.
And as the show has gone on, he's surrounded himself by more and more of these people that are actually funny. Sure. J.B. Smoove is actually funny.
Yes. Susie Essman is actually funny.
Like, I think adding these people has somehow, Richard Lewis is actually funny. Adding these people,
the
universe of the show has grown so much that it is a world populated by all these people who just can make me laugh without.
I'll just say one quick thing before you talk about J.B. Smoove. I think it's worth, because I assume that's what you were talking about.
Of course, it's my boy.
I'll just say this, that I do think that I don't want to say the cameos, but the people they bring in are also really perfectly selected in ways that even a Dylan O'Brien showing up in this last season, like, it's all just very smartly done. So even if it's someone who pops up for one episode or it's Tracy Ullman who does an arc, whatever it is, it feels very specific. It doesn't feel, famous people showing up for the sake of famous
people. The John Hamm thing was so funny.
Yeah, exactly.
That was brilliant. Like, that was really, really good. So J.B. Smoove, I think, was such a wild swing and connected in a way I almost can't fathom. I mean, that season was so funny, right? The idea was they took in a Hurricane Katrina family. I mean, like, that's how this started. They took in a Hurricane Katrina family, and over, and J.B. Smoove wasn't even part of the Fae, just lived
no,
there.
No, Vivica Fox, like, you know.
He was like, yeah, it was Vivica Fox's family, and J.B. Smoove was like her brother, who just like hung out a lot, also lived there. And by the end of the season, like, I think that was the season he divorced Cheryl and fell in love with...
Because he starts dating.
Fell in love with Vivica Fox. And that was all really funny. And then they broke up in the premiere of the next season, and J.B. Smoove just didn't leave. How do you think, the funniest thing about it now, and I love this about it, is like he still has these people in his lives, Jeff, and you know, he had Funkhauser, God rest his soul, and he had Richard Lewis, and all these people who were in his lives before this and after this, and no one even acknowledges how weird it is that this guy just never left, and he has a roommate, and it's J.B. Smoove.
It's great.
Like, the only thing about Leon, who I love, I deeply, deeply love, and I think everything's funny, is I always have this, I want more Leon, because he always makes me laugh. And I think it's a very specific intended decision to give us not that much of him. I don't like that, but it feels like that. It feels like they are meeting him out, and I feel like every season they must get because they take pictures, don't tell anyone. They must get 1,000 pictures for Leon's stories.
Don't tell anyone.
They must have this less is more with Leon thing, which is, I don't know, is that true?
I mean, well, but don't you feel like leave him wanting more? I mean, isn't that always what the adage?
I think
that's true of almost all of the supporting characters. But I think that's true of almost all of the supporting characters. Yes. You always feel like you could watch an entire show of Leon or an entire show of Susie
Cheryl.
Yeah. Or Cheryl.
Well, Leon and Susie in particular,
because they're
unbelievable comedic supporting characters. They are both like hurricanes of humor. So.
Susie is just, I mean, it's insane. Every scene she has with Larry is just, she's incredible.
I mean, the visual joke of Susie.
Yes.
Her outfits are so amazing. Like, they're so funny. They are so everything from, you know, early on her yelling about the doll head to the jackets that she made. One of my favorite more recent episodes is when he gets her the portrait. And it's all so good, but it is the same thing as Leon, where it's like they almost know the too much of a good thing. Like, you have to keep a tiny bit.
Susie and Larry play a very specific game, which I love, which is almost every time, unless like there's some, you know, pre-existing incident where Jeff did something and Larry was aware of it. But almost every time Susie enters a scene with Larry, like loving him, you know, and like every time it's like, Larry, great to see you. You got to do this. We got to do that. We're going to do this together. Yeah.
And then hates him by the end of the episode.
Yeah, he does some shit. And she plays the role of like the audience member who hates him. He's like, get the fuck out, Larry. and that's a great bit and a great game. And it always plays because they're both so good. And she's so funny. And like, I assume because the whole show's improv that she's, you know, writing these lines for herself. But just the things that come out of her mouth are so unexpected and so funny. And the vitriol she has for this guy is it's the vitriol the world has for him in you know,
personified as one person.
Yeah. The Leon game is different.
Yeah.
Leon is the angel on his shoulder, you know, angel, you know, relatively speaking, who's always egging Larry on. Love it. Leon is always like, I can't believe this happened to you. Like, you have to do something about this. You're right, Larry. This is an injustice.
A quick second, because you brought something up, Esther, that I think is worth noting, especially since you have a book that just came out about passion.
I want to talk about a book, but real fast on the J.B. Smoove thing, because I just realized this. He came about right as the show started to acknowledge what we are acknowledging throughout this conversation, is that people identify with Larry. It's that people aren't always thinking this guy is a schmuck. A lot of time people are thinking this guy is right. So J.B. Smoove came along right at that moment to validate the audience. Be like, this guy agrees with you. Sure. And I think that's really interesting now that we have these, you know, these two sides of the Larry David coin.
Also, he's so fit. There is this thing that is stuck in my head where he says, hey, just JB Smoove says, like, hey, do anchovies have to go on pizza or can you eat them loose? Loose? All the time. Can you eat them loose?
Eat them loose.
Can you eat the anchovies loose?
I wanted to ask you, Esther, because as I mentioned, you have a book that just came out about Oscar fashion. Do you want to talk about your book for a second? What is it called and where can people find it?
Thank you. It's called Beyond the Best Dressed. It is, you can find it at whatever bookseller you want to buy it from on the internet.
Sure.
It is released by Running Press. You know, support your local indie and go to bookshop.com or...
Yeah, some booksellers are better than others.
Yeah,
some booksellers are better than others.
You know,
and speaking of fashion,
support Bezos and go to Amazon.
You had an amazing Super Yaki. As a huge Bjork fan, I bought both of those shirts. So I appreciate your brilliance when it comes to your great taste in Icelandic musicians. But I'll just say this. I bring all of this up because I do think that this show is kind of iconic in terms of Larry's outfits, Susie's outfits. I feel as though Larry, who is not showy in any way, kind of has this iconography,
great style.
Yeah.
Right? Style to him that I was curious if you wanted to expand on.
Yeah, I mean, well, the aesthetic of the show is so interesting. I think to begin, like we talked about, I think before we were on mic, we were talking about Brentwood and like the idea that this like West Side style is a style, I don't know, but not in the way that like you, but not in the sort of typical way that you think of like LA style.
Exactly.
It's this sort of rich guy, casual, but
it's like
not
loungewear.
Fancy loungewear. I mean, there is that like great episode where he likes the dead guy's shirt. And then he, I think it's their interior designer and he sees the picture of the dead guy and he likes the shirt and then he goes buys the shirt and then they run into his widow and he can't believe that he just went and bought the shirt. But it is this sort of, you know, it seems comfy and yet elevated in a way. And style and fashion, I think, like, also just, it's always a part of the show. I mean, the most recent season, there was the episode where Vince Vaughn as Freddie Funkhauser, lends him his favorite shirt, and he spills on it, and it's like, why would he lend him? Just the idea of clothes also being part of the, like, an important part of the universe. Susie is antithetical to him because of the way she is loud in her fashion, and he's so quiet in it. Like, but also it's just, that, like, aspirational Brentwood rich guy, but not ostentatious fashion is so...
Well, there's something very, you know, old Jewish man who just wants to be comfortable thing.
Yes.
That courses through, especially what Larry wears. I mean, again, the Holocaust shoes come into play. They're comfortable. Again, like, it's just comfort above all else. But I just mean in the sense that he almost has a uniform. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
like, there is this kind of thing that you associate with when you think of Larry David in your head. It's just, he looks very comfortable, but also he doesn't look like
a schlub.
Exactly. He doesn't look like a schlub. It's interesting.
He did look like a schlub earlier in the run.
He did.
And
in this special, for instance.
He pulled himself together to some extent. And I don't know. I think, like, I keep thinking, Larry, it almost feels like Larry David. All right. So the Larry David of the show and the Larry David of real life made about $500 million from Seinfeld. Right? So he's a very rich man. He's a laughably rich man. Right?
Holy shit. That's crazy.
For a guy who was, you know, who couldn't even get on SNL and was on Fridays, that's pretty good. So I think he was on SNL, but then whatever. Yeah. Larry, Larry David is an exceptionally rich man. In a sense, the story, and he lives in LA, lives in Brentwood. You know, obviously Jerry stayed in New York, and you know, Larry decided to die and go to heaven instead. And I think for a lot of people in this country and this world, Larry David is quote unquote living the dream.
Sure.
He works when he wants, he does what he wants, he wears what he wants, he lives where he wants, he does everything. And it's just an interesting there is an interesting aspirational nature to this whole show. To be so privileged and comfortable to give a shit about the things he gives a shit about. Like that. Absolutely. Could you imagine to be so fucking comfortable that you can get that you can like take umbrage with all these little things and that could be your daily routine and you could have, you know, you have a wobbly table in front of you, you could speak up and he doesn't do anything and you could start a spite store next door. I think there is some like this for a lot of us, for the modern people, for a modern person living in this modern society, this does feel in a way like the ultimate wish fulfillment.
Even in the special, you know, it's there from the beginning, which is walking away from the thing that you have to do, like where he's just like, I don't want to do the stand up anymore. I just walk away from it. And yet I think what works so well about it is that like, it's stuff that you sort of like, if you did have that privilege, like, maybe you do that. Like if you did have that privilege, maybe you'd say something about the wobbly tables or, the fact that your coffee isn't hot enough, you know?
And then in real life, you would make shows when you want to make shows.
Yes.
And you would demand Final Cut. And you would say, I'm doing this episode about stealing shoes from a Holocaust survivor and no one else could. And if you don't want me to, I won't, but I just won't do the show. Like, you're not even getting a different episode. That's pretty fucking amazing. And just if you look at what other super wealthy people, crazy wealthy people, in like his, you know, his very rarefied tax bracket do, he's like the only one I think people don't get pissed about. Because he's the only one who like still feels like, you know, a fairly normal guy.
Well, because I just don't think he's interested in rubbing people's noses in his successes.
Nor is he interested in pretending that they don't exist.
Sure.
Which I think is respectful.
Which is a balance that's tricky for sure. Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting that, I mean, the Seinfeld comparison I think is apt in the sense that Seinfeld just reeks of this, look at what I've accomplished. I mean, Comedians and Cars Getting Coffee is one of those things where there's episodes in particular, moments in particular, I'm like, he just seems like a dick. He seems like a rich dick. And whether or not he's cognizant of that, he certainly doesn't care if he is. And that's just what it is. Whereas Larry doesn't feel that way. He just feels like a guy who's just, you know, first of all, he'll never be content, right? I mean, Larry feels like a guy who's always sort of in search of something. And that, I think, is the human condition, you know, amplified as well, of just someone who's always kind of longing for something. Whereas, for all intents and purposes, Jerry doesn't feel that way. Jerry feels like he's got everything.
No, Jerry's lame, and I don't know, like his thing since Seinfeld has just been like extreme lameness. Except for his stand-up specials, which are still funny. Like he still nails that, but like. Yep. B movie or The Marriage Ref or
his documentary Comedian I liked for what
it's
it was
a worth. Really good documentary that but and that feels like the kind of thing I wish he would do more of because he's obviously extremely smart but you know often misguided. I mean, isn't he doing like a Pop-Tart movie or something, Phil?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah,
so he's doing like, I mean, you know, I think but I think it's funny because we just did Up on our Patreon and I was talking about, you know, shows and things about old people. Larry's now 70 years old. You know, when he started this, I mean, in this show, he's in his late 40s. And the thing we're doing, he's in his late 40s. Jeff, by the way, is 37, which is a mind fuck. But Larry is in his late 40s. Now he is 70 years old.
Looks the same.
He looks so good. He's like, the greatest trick Larry ever pulled was this idea that he can just, you know, that beautiful women will throw themselves at him and it's believable. But
it is 100%
not
believable.
Even because of the money.
It is 100%. Yeah, no.
It's not because of the money.
It's also the aesthetic. Like, it's the, there's something that works. Like,
I gotta say, he's got a nice face. He's just got a nice face. Like, so Larry, all right. So I hope this show goes on until he dies. And I hope he dies at about 100 years old. Because I hope he's, like, I hope he has that Norman Lear thing where he can still produce at a high level into his 90s and even be on screen. Because I think that would be a really exciting thing. I think that'd be a really great thing for society 100%. To watch this old man kill it. So I 70's not old anymore. You know, 70's, that's true, you know, too. 70 is like whatever. Like, you get in your 80s, then we could start talking.
I'm looking at his Emmy nominations and wins. And it's kind of crazy that he's never won for acting. He's been nominated 6 times for Curb. He's only won 2 Emmys in 93. He won for Seinfeld when it won Best Series and for The Contest, which, sure. I mean, arguably one of the best episodes of television. But I'm just fascinated by how much love Curb gets on the nomination side and yet never seems to actually pull out a win. Yeah.
I think Curb is something weirdly we take for granted. Maybe less so in like these past 2 seasons, because it feels sort of like miraculous that they existed after that absent. Like, you know, season 11, like season 9 was sort of an off season. That's the Fatwa season. Like it's, you know, there's good stuff there, but it just didn't feel as strong. And then it just like came back out of the gate. And so it just almost feels like, you know, we are so like, we so take it for granted.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. So I'm looking at the years, I mean, in terms of when it aired. And it's interesting that, you know, you got 03, 04, then 6, 8, 10, 12, 16. There's a big gap between 2012 and 2016. I agree with you that we take it for granted. But I also think that comes back to sort of what we were saying earlier of like, Larry's going to do this when Larry wants to do this. And if he's going to take a 4-year absence, he's going to take a 4-year absence. And I think that part of that is to what you were just saying, Esther, of making sure that the quality is where it needs to be and that he is, you know, that he's happy with the output. I also imagine, I mean, he's nominated in 2016 for SNL for playing Bernie. And I imagine that to some degree or another, that probably affected production in terms of him having to fly back and forth between New York and LA. But I do think that it's, I mean, I agree with you 100%, Kenny. I hope the show runs forever. I hope that Larry keeps doing it as long as he possibly can. I hope he is a Mel Brooksian or a Norman Lear type who just keeps going until
I think he will. And I think, you know, he never had to do anything. And I think if he didn't want to do anything, he wouldn't have done anything. That's very clear to me from this guy. If he wanted to go and play golf, he would have gone and played golf. I think he has a lot to say. I really do. I think he has a lot to say. I think, you know, you see it in interviews and you see it, you know, everything you read about him. He is, he was a proponent of electric cars before that was a thing. He's a social justice warrior to some extent. He is, you know, vocally anti-Trump. He is out there in a way that doesn't feel, you know, your typical Hollywood liberal thing that everyone despises. I mean, I don't think people on the other side of the aisle give a shit, which is kind of an amazing thing.
And to your point, I don't think that he's seen as a particularly political figure, and yet I do think he is. Do you know what I mean? Like,
people know, but I don't think they care.
Yes,
right. Like, I think he's kind of held up by the right as like the kind of liberal that people can stomach.
No, for sure, for sure. I think that there's also something, you know, in terms of this show doing what Larry wants it to be. I mean, we talked about this at the top, but you know, this was a one-time project for him. This episode of what we're talking about in terms of the special was a one-time thing. I think that it was, he had an itch he wanted to scratch and he wasn't sure how it was going to work. And it obviously worked. It's turned into a thing that he can do what he wants to do with. But even just looking at this, the rounded offness of this 1 hour special, the fact that the whole thing is about him doing a stand-up special that he doesn't actually do is so perfectly this show. The idea of him never doing the HBO special.
And also the idea that, like, you know what you were saying, Kenny, about like how good he is at stand-up, but yeah, like, he's not actually, it's sort of like, it's almost like the special was like him testing out stand-up. He decides he doesn't want to do stand-up, but he figures out that like the format of the special is something that he likes to do. Yeah. It's a very Larry way of like figuring it out.
And the thing about Larry that is like, to me, like the greatest trick he's ever pulled, mm-hmm, or greatest is in the end of the day, I think this is true for Lena Dunham too. Mm-hmm. In the end of the day, as bumbling as our characters might be and the way they're always stepping in shit, you can't deny that the real versions of them made these shows. And they are like incredibly like creative, functional visionaries.
Yep.
And I think that they, like Lena Dunham, who I, you know, love, has fallen victim to people conflating her character with her real life persona.
Especially in the beginning. Yeah.
In the beginning, but even now, I think people like, you know, think Hannah is Lena and forget that actually, no, Lena created Hannah and everything else that you saw on that show. Larry, like, yeah, I think it's interesting that he makes this show essentially about his process of deciding that stand-up's not for him. And at the end of the day, he's left with something even more amazing and it just keeps making it. So he's like, yeah.
I also appreciate that he gets rid of the stand-up component. Like, there's a part of me like, because that feels, first of all, very Seinfeldian, right? Obviously, you know, with the stand-up bits.
That's how Seinfeld started, yeah.
So, and is a hallmark of the show. And I do feel like getting rid of the stand-up is essential, but also, and you said this earlier, Kenny, the show feels like stand-up bits that have been unpacked in, I think, a much more clever way than just telling us, you know, straight to the camera.
The original pitch of Seinfeld was, let's do a show about how a stand-up comedian gets his material.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Which, of course, the real show would be very boring. We saw the real show in Comedian. It's a guy. It's a depressed person sitting in his apartment, pinning index cards to his wall.
Yeah.
But, you know, they started Seinfeld that way. And if you could see it in the early episodes. He does his stand up at the beginning of the episode. And then you kind of see the way it informs the show. This actually does feel like that without the explicit, let's show how a stand-up gets his bits. This actually feels like signed like Larry. And I know this to some extent to be true. Like Larry just, you know, with his producers, whether it's Bob Whitey, whether it's, you know, Jeff Schaefer now, whether it's Alan Zweibel, these like, you know, Karen Leifer, these luminaries, they just sit and beat the shit out of these ideas. And then they're like, all right, let's give it to our brilliant improvisers to see what they say.
Yeah, it's a fascinating animal to look at from 30,000 feet as a television show, the way that the structure of it, the way that it actually comes to be. You know, Kenny mentioned, obviously, that they're open to pitches to some degree or another. It's very organic. It all feels very, it all feels very organic and smartly done. Esther, just kind of to mirror what you were saying, I do think that we take it for granted because it seems so quote unquote easy. You know what I mean? It's just, it goes down very easy. It's a show that's really funny. It's a show that's very smart. Do you, Esther, have a favorite season? Do you have a favorite arc that jumps out to you?
I was talking about this recently, and we were talking about favorite episodes.
Sure, sure, sure.
I But I love the New York season, not the producer season, the Cheryl post-divorce New York season, which has one of my favorite episodes, which is the one with the little gay kid who Larry teaches about Hitler.
He does love the Holocaust.
Yeah, he does love the Holocaust. That is one of my
gay kid that Larry tells about Hitler is incredible.
Well, yeah, he buys him a sewing machine, and then he makes Susie a pillow sham with a swastika on it because Larry is going around drawing swastikas and Hitler mustaches on every magazine that he encounters. And that's also the Michael J. Fox season, which I love. I don't know. I mean,
sure.
There's so many seasons. I really did love the Mocha Joe season. I mean, one of my favorite episodes, sort of an underrated episode, I think, is the Freak Book, where Larry gives Ted a book of sideshow freaks at Ted's birthday party, and then immediately takes it back, and they're at this party, Jeff and Larry just start reading the freak book and laughing and can't stop, you know.
Oh my god,
yeah,
it's great. Kenny, do you have any favorites?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm the one that always jumped out to me that was just like, you know, almost like your version of the Holocaust shoes moment was Crazy Eyes Killer. Like, I just couldn't believe Crazy Eyes Killer. I couldn't believe was happening. Like, there's my Caucasian. A lot of people say, you know, that kind of gave birth this idea of like maybe Larry should have a recurring black sidekick, but he was Wanda's boyfriend. He's like loving, yeah. Like they just, it, there was, it just had this like same JB Smoove energy, which was just like, someone gets Larry and it's this gangster rapper. And like, I loved that episode. I think I'm just looking at the guy who played Crazy Eyes Killer because he was so funny and perfect. And he's in a lot of shit, so I should at least say his name.
It is a really special show that I think when it's done, whenever it's done, I do think that it really sort of has etched itself into television history in a way that is entirely its own. And I think that I imagine that Larry David loves that it's kind of taken for granted a little bit.
His name is Chris Williams. He's in a ton of shit.
Okay. I'd be very curious to hear. I don't feel like Larry David wants a legacy is what I'm sort of saying. Like, I think Larry David would be fine with just existing and then perhaps being forgotten. And maybe I don't say that to say that he will, because I don't think he will be. I think he has a legacy, but I just wonder whether or not he gives a shit about that at all.
I don't think he gives a shit. Yeah. Normally I would look for the contrarian point of view on that one, but I really don't think he.
Esther, thank you so much. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, like, that's the purity of Curb, is that like, he just wants to keep doing it when it's funny, you know?
Yeah, I mean, not to belabor the point, but I really do think that there's something to the freedom that Kenny was referring to earlier,
yeah,
of him being able to say, I'm going to do it when I want to do it, and I'm going to do it when it's good, and when it's bad, or when I feel like I don't have it in me right now or whatever, I'm going to walk away from it.
It's wonderful. It genuinely feels like, in a way, he's the only person on TV who makes TV not from a place of fear, but from a place of love. And that is almost impossible in our current. Even the $100 million people on Netflix, the Shondas and Ryan Murphys, et cetera, still have to, you know, service those deals. And there is like a certain amount of fear and reputational fear from that. And I sense it in every show I watch that everybody involved knows that this is the, you know, being seen by hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, and this is your chance. You know, this is your chance to break out and become someone like Larry David. And he just does it because he loves it. And that's, well, I can't think of anyone else who
yeah, it's it that way. I fully agree with you, Kenny. You know, both of us working in television, this show obviously
I'm
is
very fearful all the time.
Yes, as am I. as am I every day. I think that it's part of it is that this show is also sort of about the making of television. At least some seasons are. Yeah. So I think to some degree or another, there's that kind of metatextualism that I'm drawn to.
It certainly gets how much downtime there is in the making of television. Right.
It very much conveys how little actual work is being done when you're making a television show. And I mean, my God, this last season, there were so many great bits in the making of Young Larry. I mean, the roping off of his chair. There was just a lot of stuff that, you know, Kenny and I obviously spend a fair amount of time on set, and it does convey very well the vibe of being on set. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. I think it's a really, it's a special show in so many ways. And I do think that I mean, Kenny, you wrote in comedy. I never did. So you know what it's like when things, quote unquote, can always be funnier. And I think that that's something that this show navigates beautifully as well.
Mm-hmm. It's not true. Things can't always be funny. Yeah.
It's not true. Things can't always be funny.
Then Curb can't be funnier. Comedy is... And I think any comedy writer would tell you this. Writing comedy is hell. Writing comedy, particularly with a group of people, it's like it's a fucking nightmare. I don't believe Curb is like that, because I don't believe the people are. I believe everyone's secure enough to let everyone else shine. Like,
there isn't a room either.
There's not a room, but there is a room. There are a bunch of people talking to each other about the show. But the beauty and purity of like improv among people who aren't famous, or sometimes who are famous, is like the willingness and in fact the imperative to let other people shine.
Yes. Yes.
That's the whole goal, you know, is to make everybody else look good. Mm-hmm. Somewhere from the stages of UCB into the writers' rooms of, you know, Fox and Paramount, people forgot that. And it was all about making yourself shine. And that's a big issue with comedy writing.
I'm sure I've told this story before. I've certainly told it to you, Kenny. The only time I've ever been in a comedy room was I past and future guest Hunter Covington had me in a punch-up room for a pilot he did many years ago. It was a nightmare for me. I'm not a comedy writer, but also just no one laughs at anything. Everyone just says, that's funny. It was fucking brutal. It was awful.
Who else was in that room?
Oh, God. I'm trying to remember. I mean, obviously, Hunter, Stacey. There was Susanna Fogel was in that room. It was one of those things, as I'm sure you know, Esther. It was a multi-cam comedy. They were shooting the pilot. So in between days of shooting, you would have nights where people would try to do punch-up of the stuff that was coming down the pike in future days.
I've done it too. It's very upsetting.
Oh, I was just like, this is awful. Who does this? Why does anyone want to do this?
No, I barely feel comfortable pitching jokes among people I know. But to go into a room of six people I don't know who are all good at this.
Yes.
You know?
Oh. Yes. Awful. Awful. Oh. It's a fascinating thing. And that's why I think this show, again, occupies such an interesting lane of not doing that, what we're talking about, right? Of not sort of falling prey to all of the sort of shitty things that happen in comedy television in so many ways. It's pretty brilliant. But Esther, thank you so, so much for coming on to talk about this with us. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
We hope that you'll come back and talk about...
We got to talk about Curb. How exciting. We figured it out.
Great. My favorite thing.
We hope that you'll come back and talk about either more TV or movies or anything like that in the future. But this was an absolute blast.
To. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you? And is there anything that you want to talk about, to plug?
You can find me Twitter, Easy Writes, and read my stuff on Thrillist.com and buy my book, available at bookstores online.
You can also hear her amazing episodes of Blank Check, which are fantastic, and everyone should listen to those as well.
Yeah.
But
you,
yeah.
You know she's good because she didn't go for the obvious Easy Writer joke on Twitter. So good for you. Yeah.
Oh, I definitely tried when I got a Twitter in when it was like 2009 and I was in
someone
college.
Someone already had it?
Yeah.
I'm going to go tweet at them for being unfunny.
Lame. All right. This was fantastic. Thank you so much, Esther.
See ya.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.